Hello, and welcome to Profiles. This is Bob Willard, and we will be visiting today with Leonard Hokanson, internationally recognized piano recitalist, soloist, and chamber musician, and professor of music at Indiana University. For the next hour or so, we will visit with Leonard, ask a few questions, and then play some music, and meet the person behind the persona. Leonard, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you.
Leonard has performed with such orchestras as the Berlin Philharmonic, the Bavarian Radio Orchestra, the Rotterdam Philharmonic, the Salzburg Mozarteum Orchestra, and the Vienna Symphony. He has performed duo recitals with violinist Miriam Fried, clarinetist James Campbell, and horn player Herman Baumann. And he has also collaborated with song recitalists Martina Royo, Grace Bumbry, Edith Mathis, Edda Moser, Arlene Auger, and Hermann Pry. He studied with the great Arthur Schnabel, his son Carl Ulrich Schnabel, Claude Frank, and Julian de Grey. He's retiring at the end of this year from his position as professor of piano at Indiana University in Bloomington. Leonard, to become a good pianist takes immense dedication and hard work. Where did this tenacity come from?
Well, a lot of it came from my mother, I think, because she noticed when I was very young that I had a great sense of rhythm and that I liked to listen to music. And so she decided that I needed to play an instrument, and she taught herself to play, of all things, the accordion. I grew up in a Swedish community, and accordion was, of course, the instrument of choice. And then she taught me to play the accordion, and I loved it, and I would practice and practice and practice and play all kinds of Swedish tunes and whatever music we could find until I finally got to a piano when I was about 10, very late. And then I just continued to practice. I don't think one had to force me to practice. I just loved to play.
But let's go back then. You started in a small island off the coast of
Maine. I was born on a very small island off the coast of Maine, a little island called Vinylhaven. And I grew up in a Swedish community. There was the big industry there outside of lobsters, which when I was born and growing up, lobsters were not that much of a marketing item as they are today. But there were big granite quarries on the island, and the streets of New York are lined with paving blocks from this little island. You know, it's amazing. And my father was a paving cutter. The island consisted of about 20% Scandinavians and 80% old Yankees who had grown up on the island. And so that's where I started to get acquainted with music, Swedish music, and that sort of thing.
They had no piano there?
Some people had old uprights and I think even a Tafel piano someplace. But basically, there wasn't one available for me, so that's when I was taught the accordion in its place, and friends of my mother, who members of the Boston Symphony, as a matter of fact, can you imagine people from the Boston Symphony being born on this island also? First tuba player, trombone player. And they used to come visiting the island during the summers and told my mother, I'm a very musical chap, and therefore, as soon as we get off the island, don't forget, this is the end of the 30s, big depression in the States, and we had to leave the island and move to Brooklyn, New York, and then from Brooklyn on to Worcester, Massachusetts, where I really began studying the piano. But these friends of my mother told me, just keep him reading as much material on the accordion as possible to get him to sight read so that when he's older, he'll have no difficulty at all. And the minute you get off the island, find the piano. And that's basically what happened. In Massachusetts, I began studying piano seriously, although I continued with the accordion. It's amazing how many people did begin with the accordion, you know.
Well, how did you learn to play with your left hand then?
I had a very crippled. Well, I didn't have a. You know how when you play. Well, you can picture someone playing the accordion with a keyboard on the right side and buttons on the left. So your wrist, you look like the dying swan. Your wrist is high up in the air. And so for years playing, my teachers were just trying to push my left hand wrist down so it sort of matched the look of the right, you know? But, I mean, I had great facility in my right hand because I'd started the accordion very young, but my left hand was sort of out to lunch for quite some time. But then I did manage with enough practice to alleviate that problem.
Well, how old were you then when you first played the piano?
How old was that? 1943. I was almost 12 years old. My first piece that my piano teacher gave me was a Mozart D minor concerto. So you can see that I was already sort of advanced as far as the right hand was concerned, and my left hand came trailing after. So it's not as though I was starting with five finger exercises, although I had to practice those also. But I mean, I was pretty advanced. So when I say 12, I was not a 12-year-old beginner. My first teacher, who I'm very grateful to for learning a lot, teaching me a lot of things that I appreciate now, had been a student of Heinrich Gebhardt, who had been a student of Liszt. So already there I was sort of in the line of Liszt, which then, of course, I continued to be when I studied with Arthur Schnabel, who was a student of Lev Shatitsky.
What did you do to develop the strength, the agility, and catch your left hand up with your right?
Well, I had to do a lot of left-hand exercises, left-hand etudes also. I mean, I remember one of the first things I had to learn was the Revolutionary Etude of Chopin, of course, which is, for the left hand, quite prohibitively difficult if you don't have any strength. So I managed somehow. I also did a lot of unison work and scale work, that sort of thing. And little by little, my left hand wasn't absolutely inert. But I mean, the fingertips weren't developed much, you know. So I had to do a lot of working on the incisive sound that you only can produce with very active fingertips, you know. And so that's little by little, the left hand sort of it never overtook the right, but it sort of got stronger and stronger, so it would match.
There must have been some frustrating times in there, then.
Yeah, you know, when I think about it, I don't really think it bothered me that much. If your right hand's well developed, your left hand many times will just sort of imitate, you know what I mean? I mean, it shouldn't imitate, because left hand and right hand have many different functions in playing the piano. But somehow the left, I never felt, I did feel a lack of strength many times. But well, then I used to play ragtimes and you know that jumping, striding bass, and that sort of helped me also, you know, as far as hitting the right notes and jumps.
I think we don't need to belabor this, but you mentioned something about the fingertips.
Yeah. Well, that's one of my pet theories, is that the fingertip, the action of the fingertip, the sort of caressing bit, is what creates nuance. You know, when I did a lot of, as you know, accompanying, I should say collaborating. I hate the word accompany, you know. I try to get that word out of the dictionary or out of the vocabulary of IU. It's not easy to do. But in any case, this idea of creating nuance through this sort of pulling out, you know, the fingertip, that I find, with all the arm weight in the world, you can't create the sort of focused sound that you need. If you're working with a singer or the violinist who has an incredibly wide palette of colors, from, let's say, the softest, let's say, a pianissimo, and that with the sound that's focused, well, many times, if you're playing a Schubert song, for example, you've got to produce the same kind of focused sound. And you can only do that if you've got some tension in the fingertip producing the sound, you know? That's my whole theory about producing sound.
Well, you mentioned a minute ago that the first piece you learned was a Mozart piano concerto. Can we listen to some Mozart, part of a Mozart piano concerto that you're playing?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Well, why don't we do that?
Okay, fine. One of my favorites is the first big concerto that Mozart composed, which is the Jeune Homme, or the E-flat number 9, Kerschel 271, which I fortunately recorded so that you have a recording of that.
Well, let's play part of the last
movement. Sure.
Last movement. Mm-hmm. And that's with an orchestra conducted by Kurt Riddell.
Kurt Riddell. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We have just heard a portion of the last movement of the Mozart Piano Concerto No. 9 in E-flat, Kershaw Listing 271, with our guest Leonard Hokanson on piano and an orchestra conducted by Kurt Rodell. During your time of discovery, of learning your love for music, what were the personal talents you discovered that helped you move forward into the world of professional music?
Maybe one of the things that was very important, that I was interested in all kinds of music, not just piano music, but I liked playing chamber music, and I would seek out people to perform with. Singers also, although singers didn't play the role in my young life when I was still studying, that they did later on. But one of the things that I would love to do was to also listen to string quartets, even young, I mean, without being prodded and without, I know I studied music, but I was always interested in other sounds that I could maybe then try to copy or try to imitate or find ways of making a piano sound like other instruments, you know, the sound of an oboe, plangent sound of an oboe, or string, the bowing of a violin, how I could sort of copy the bowings on the piano, you know. And those things really interest me. I always was surrounded also by, I had great good luck in my choice of friends, a lot of older friends who were very helpful, and also older musicians who sort of fostered my talent. And that was very fortunate for me because through them I got to know a lot of repertoire at a very young age and did a lot of different kind of music, which was going to keep me really in good stead later on in life when I entered the professional world, you know. And I think the most important thing was that I was able to sight read and could read all these things, so it wasn't a matter that I had to prepare everything long in advance in order to play with my friends, you know. When I started professionally, I also played the harpsichord and the forte piano and things like this, but that's a little later in the game after I got out of the Army. So after finishing my education, I was fortunate enough to be sent to Germany, and I could speak the language because I had majored in German in college. After studying with my first teacher in Worcester, Massachusetts, these older friends I'm talking about who were so interested in my career decided that it was time that I studied with a real master and wrote a letter to a man named Arthur Schnabel. And, you know, Arthur Schnabel was at that time, as he still is, one of the most revered musicians and pianists in the world. And you just didn't write letters to Arthur Schnabel. At least my mother didn't. Like, my God, how do we get in touch with him? Well, these friends wrote, and he got an answer. We got an answer. Please come down and play for me. So this was 1948. So I played for Arthur Schnabel, and he took me on as a student. That is, I didn't study as I studied with him and with his son, Karl Ulrich, who was also a wonderful pedagogue. And I worked with in the Schnabel school, should put it that way, until 1951, until the death of Schnabel. He was not associated with any school, so that my mother decided, or our friends decided, I needed a liberal arts education. So I went to Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts, a wonderful school, and majored in German because I wanted to be able to read. I think I wanted to read Schumann's Neue Zeitschrift für Musik. You know, I wanted to be able to read German works in the original. And I'd commute twice a month to New York to have my lesson with Schnabel or Karl Ulrich. And when I was through with, after he died, I got my Bachelor of Arts in German at BA at Clark University. And Karl Ulrich decided he was going to leave after his father's death, he was going to teach for a year in South America. So he said, you have a choice. You've got to continue to study. I would recommend either Claude Frank or Leonard Schur, who was also a Schnabel disciple in Boston. I had the good luck, or maybe was wise of me to choose Claude Frank. After working with Claude for a couple of lessons, he said, why don't you come to Bennington College and work for your master's there? I teach there, rather than coming to New York and studying privately with me. So I took a couple of exams in the summer of 52 to see if I could get a teaching fellowship at Bennington in music. And I'd had good luck in high school in Worcester because there was offered 3 years of harmony and theory. Can you believe that in the high school? Along with 2 years of German and 3 years of Latin. I mean, it's just a normal high school. of the 40s. But it was incredible, the education you got in the high school in those years. Anyway, I've got the teaching fellowship. I worked at Bennington for 2 years with Claude. Got to know Lieder through the one of the teachers there. His name was Leslie Shabai, a wonderful Hungarian singer with whom I worked, Thibaut Kozma, who used to be a conductor here. And he was a pianist who worked with his tenor, and they would prepare concerts together. And I would prepare with the singer so he would know what he had to sing, Bartok songs and Schubert Winterreise, things like that. My first contact with this music. Anyway, after getting my degree there, then I was drafted, and I spent 6 miserable months, first at Fort Dix, New Jersey, 104, walking forced marches through the sands of Fort Dix, and then a couple of months at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, which wasn't much better, because the only oasis of culture there was Grand Old Opry in Nashville, about 50 miles away. Well, anyway, our division got rotated, as they say, to Germany, and there, since I could speak the language, I got to know in my free time musicians and met someone who was very interested in Schnabel and Schnabel's teaching. So a surgeon and a very influential patron of the arts. I was stationed in Augsburg, Germany, who then, after meeting him, he said, you have to play a concert, and I want to hear, people have to hear you. So I played a concert in my army boots and all that, you know, sort of a good policy concert between the army and the civilians, you know, always necessary. And then I was, through this concert that I played, I was offered a concert for next year at a time when I'd be released from the army. So my choice was, should I come back or should I just stay and start to build a career here in Germany, which I decided to do. And so I spent the next, how many years? Well, from 1957 until 1986 in Germany, living in Augsburg and making a career there. First of all, I was successful in the Busoni competition in Bolzano, and then I met a lot of musicians in Munich and played. Well, anyway, it's a beautiful, but it was a very famous, very important city back in the 1600s and 1700s. It's on what you call Romantic Street, the Romantische Straße, and it's also the home of Mozart's father. So Leopold Mozart taught in Augsburg, and there's a Leopold Mozart house. Bert Brecht was born in Augsburg. A number of interesting people were born. There's a big cultural life there. And, of course, Munich's only about, by Autobahn, about 30 minutes away. So it's I did a lot of commuting. I had a job there playing the organ and conducting the choir in the American Chapel. That's how I sort of subsisted for a while, and doing odd jobs with piano and things like that, and getting some concerts, and then meeting musicians from the Bavarian Radio Orchestra, who did a lot of radio tapes. You know, the Bavarian Radio had contracts with all their players, orchestra players, that during the year they each would produce one studio production. And they, of course, need pianists for that. And they heard about this man in Augsburg who was a good sight reader. You know, that goes back to my accordion days when my mother force-fed me, you know, with Swedish dances and things like this. So that's how I got to know a lot of the good musicians there. I also then offered concerts to play the Trout Quintet and all this sort of thing. And then one thing led to another. I wasn't earning all that much money that much money, period. And once someone called me and said, can you play the harpsichord? And I said, of course, because it seemed that the harpsichord of a famous chamber orchestra's harpsichordist had just had a heart attack, and this orchestra was going on tour to starting England and going through France and needed someone to play Fitz Brandenburg and continue all kinds of things. And I said, sure. So I just bought a book on how to play the harpsichord. And
you'd never played the harpsichord before?
Well, I never had a chance to see a harpsichord anywhere. So, I mean, that's one thing. We didn't have a Clark University, and Schnabel didn't teach the harpsichord either. So I called someone who's quite famous, a harpsichordist, Karl Richter, the famous Bach person in Munich, who I had met and who liked my playing. So I asked him about playing the harpsichord, and I needed to learn quickly. Could you give me a lesson? He said, all you need to do is don't ever forget that you can play legato on the harpsichord. So just try to play. It's like you're playing the piano with no arm weight, with fingers, you know. And so I did. So for the next 2 years, I played a lot of harpsichord with this orchestra and even got to record Bach Fifth Brandenburg with Lauren Mazel you can believe that. And Telemann Fantasies, I was getting quite a name as a harpsichord virtuoso. And then...
let's go back to the harpsichord, because I want to listen to a recording of that.
Yeah.
I like the million-dollar lesson you got was you can play legato on the harpsichord. That was it?
Well, that was it. But then when I finally got to the harpsichord, there were five pedals looking me straight in the eye. And, of course, one was 4 foot, 8 foot, 16 foot, couple, all that sort of thing. And I have very big feet, as you can very well see. So I had to buy very pointed shoes so that I could push down these very narrow pedals. And sometimes it got a little embarrassing. I remember playing a Fifth Brandenburg on the French Riviera in Menton. And it was an open-air concert. And the winds, the wonderful winds were coming in from the Mediterranean, just knocking the harpsichord for a loop, you know. And I was playing my cadenza, and one by one, each register sort of died out. So I was manipulating down there. You're supposed to end in a crescendo, you know, and I was ending in a diminuendo. By the time the orchestra came in, there was not much left except sort of a shadowy little sound coming out of the harpsichord. But, I mean, you learn by doing sometimes, you know, so you really had to sort of adjust the feet. While you're playing on two pedals, two keyboards also. But I mean, I had great fun playing.
We had to do that for the organ, too.
Sure, absolutely.
Well, let's go. Can we listen to some harpsichord?
Sure.
Let's hear a section of the first movement of the Telemann Fantasia in A major as played by Leonard Hokanson. We have just heard a section of the first movement of the Telemann Fantasia in A major played by our guest today, Leonard Hokanson. Now, I'd like to get into the realm of technical elements of piano playing. You've talked about fingertips and so forth, but aren't there different schools of piano technique, the Russian and the French?
Sure. Now, there are. And I am, since I've done so much chamber music and you know, when you're playing chamber music or with strings or with winds or doing songs with a famous baritone like Hermann Prey, one thing is pretty clear, that the sound of a wind instrument, the sound of a string instrument, or sound of a voice, the sound just continues. You know, through the bow, a violinist can produce a sound that is everlasting. And a singer with enough breath can produce a long, long sound. We on the playing the piano, of course, have a difficulty there because our tone disintegrates. We don't have a vibrato. We have a pedal that would hold a sound longer. But basically, we are dealing with disintegration of tone at all times. For me, the easiest way or the only way for me to produce a sound that is as long... Well, as long as possible, is to produce a horizontal sound, that I play horizontally in that I... You know how a plane will come in for a landing and sort of come in on the runway and continue to move rather than stopping like this? Well, I try to do that on the piano in that I try to depress the key with a lot of weight many times, but not an instant sort of going down to the bottom of the key. To produce that kind of a sound that will last longer. You know what I mean?
Does your finger slide on the key?
It slides. You know, one of the things, I remember a wonderful teacher in Germany, his name was Ludwig Hoffmann. He's quite a famous virtuoso. He would take out the board that is bordering on the keyboard, and so that the students would look into the keyboard, into the bowels of the piano, you know, to have the feeling that they could use the full length of the key, that they weren't restricted to just one part of the key. And I think that's very important that I do the same thing. I go almost up to the board, up to the to where it doesn't. I can't go any farther, just to get the feeling that the sound, psychologically, that the sound is going to continue. Because what happens is that the hammer doesn't hit, if you play depress the key like this, the hammer doesn't hit directly. It hits more slowly and vibrates longer. And I feel that through that, that the sound basically imitates that of a string player or a wind player of a singer, you know? And I try to cultivate that because I play a lot of chamber music. Of course, if you're playing the Tchaikovsky concerto, you want a big sound. You're going to go down to the, let's say, down to the bottom of the key as quickly as possible. Also, when you're playing Prokofiev Matelato, you don't want that kind of sustained sound. You want more of a percussive sound. Most of the music I deal with is the Vienna classics and the romantics. This kind of a sound, you know, if you're playing the pianos of their period, because I've also played forte piano and I've played instruments of the 19th century, the sound is a lot stringier. Let's say, I mean, when I say stringier, I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I mean that it's more of a string sound of a string player than it is of a piano, you know? And that a string sound is of longer duration. And that's the kind of sound I'm trying to produce, especially, you know, if you're playing, let's say, a sonata of Brahms, and you're playing, and he's going to do the same thing, you're going to look pretty silly if your sound is sort of deep of the moment and not of a duration, you know? And so I'm sure other pianists do the same thing, but I'm always constantly aware and try to tell my students also to produce, the word is horizontal and the word is not vertical. Schnabel also, all his lessons, always said, never think down. Always think forward. Don't think backward. But think that you're pushing the tone forward or pulling the tone to yourself. But don't think that you're going down through the bottom of the key bed. Now, if I'm playing Prokofiev Third Sonata, I'm going to get my Matelato in action and I'm going to try to ruin the piano, you know? Not ruin it, but you know what I mean? It's going to be a completely different approach.
Well, it makes use of the percussive percussive part of the piano.
And it's interesting, you know, with Schubert, because I told you I played a lot of forte piano. That was the next step after the harpsichord. I became a forte pianist because someone in Salzburg said, "Do you play the forte piano?" I said, "Sure."
You mean you hadn't played that either?
I hadn't played that either. So I became a forte pianist for 2 years, recorded all the Mozart trios, Beethoven trios. And it's, you know, I had learned, I don't think I touched upon this, that my first teacher was a real finger mensch, that I was always dealing, I've told you how I dealt with the fingertips and developing here. And later teachers like Julian de Grey, who you mentioned at the very beginning, he'd been a student of Tobias Matte, and Matte was the weight-dropping school of piano playing. So that I added to my repertoire much later, the idea of using a lot of arm weight and then combining the fingertip with the arm, of course, is the ideal way to play the piano. On a forte piano, you just better not use all that arm weight, because if you do, the piano will be lying at your feet, you know, the way it did in Beethoven's time, you know? So what you do, I had no trouble at all with the forte piano because I would just suspend my weight and just use the fingertip action. And as a result, it was fascinating, you know, a very small dip on a forte piano. I mean, it's just about half an inch, you know? And there you really had to work with the nerve ends in your fingertip to produce the sound, you know? Mm-hmm.
It seems that some of the great instrumentalists, conductors, and so forth find their solace, find their heart, find their real love is in chamber music. What is it about that that so attracts the great musicians?
Well, it's like any game. I mean, that you're tossing the ball back and forth between. If you're playing a Brahms trio, it's just wonderful because you're sort of, it's a conversation. Let's put it that way, and it's a conversation with all kinds of with a lot more variety. A monologue is great. I'm talking in terms of if you're playing piano solo, that's a monologue. But the minute you're doing a dialogue or let's say you're talking to three people or you're playing a piano quintet, you've got all kinds of different colors because of the colors of the instrument. And people will be saying the same thing you're saying, but they're saying it in a different register. So it's basically an incredibly interesting, colorful conversation. And I mean, the great composers have done, I mean, they throw a theme back and forth between the piano and the cello and the violin. And this also calls, if you're a pianist, calls for different kinds of highlighting. Let's say you're playing a supportive role with the viola or a supporting role with the violin in the high register. You play differently. You may be playing the same notes, but you're playing differently. It really, one person sets off the other so that you're always alive. It's like when you're having a conversation, you've got to be on the ball. And it's the same thing with playing chamber music, you know? That's like some players, you know, who play side by side but not together. I mean, they're completely together, but they're working, basically playing, you know, side by side.
Well, do you have a recording that you've brought that we could listen to of you playing some chamber music with someone?
I have something which is interesting, is that Mozart piano quartet, you know, that I have where I play the forte piano.
What movement would you like to hear?
The first, that's the most dramatic. That's okay, Mozart, that is most one of Mozart's greatest pieces, you know.
We have just heard a section of the first movement of the Mozart Piano Quartet played by Leonard Hokanson and friends. Can you tell us a little bit about who the other artists are and when this recording was made?
Oh, sure. The recording, when was this made? This is quite in the 60s, I guess. I was a member of a group called the Salzburg Mozart Trio, and we recorded for Harmonia Mundi at the time all the trios, and they wanted also the piano quartets. So it was Annegret Diedrichsen was the violinist, and Wolfgang Herzer, who was the solo cellist of the Vienna Philharmonic, and violist, his name is Jürgen Giese. And we did both of these piano quartets with a copy of the original Walter Forte Piano, which is in Salzburg's Mozart's Wohnhaus in Salzburg.
So you're playing an authentic instrument,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh, boy. You have collaborated, I guess is the right
Thank
word,
you.
With some of the great singers of the past 30 years. We mentioned them at the beginning. What is it about this repertoire, the leader, the recital, that is so fulfilling?
Well, I have to admit that I love poetry also, and the idea that you can collaborate with a singer who was reciting in music great poetry of Heine and Goethe and you name it, you know, Rückert. I also love the human voice, and I've had great good luck of working with some of the most beautiful voices of the past, let's say, 50 years. I mean, this is something else that's rather strange, that while I was playing the harpsichord and the forte piano, I was pretty busy and also playing my solo things, but also an offer came, as it had with the harpsichord. A friend of mine who was a bass fiddle player in Munich and who also ran a concert agency in Munich called me on a Thursday asking me if I were interested, if I could possibly play a song recital with Grace Bunbury on the following Sunday, because her pianist had also had a heart attack. I mean, people are always having heart attacks to my benefit, you know. It's not that the people died. They recovered, let's put it that way. But in any case, I said, what's the repertoire? Yeah, Dvorak, Gypsy songs, and Schumann, Family, Mund, Leben. I knew what these pieces were, but I'd never played them. But I said, of course I know this repertoire. So I went out and bought the music and went to Munich to rehearse with Miss Bunbury, who I knew by reputation. She was a very big star in Germany because she had been the first Afro-American singer ever to sing in Bayreuth, you know, that pinnacle. And she played the role of Venus in Tannhäuser, and she was called the Black Venus. And she made, of course, the voice was absolutely glorious, and she looked wonderful. So on the basis of that, she was offered some big tours as a leader singer. And, you know, people say, well, leader singer, could Grace sing leader? Well, she'd been a prize student of Lottie Lehmann, Santa Barbara. And she didn't sing spiritual. She sang the real thing. I mean, she sang, not that spiritual is not the real thing, but, I mean, she didn't want to be, as Marian Anderson before would sing Schubert and Brahms and end with Negro Spirit. spirituals, you know. And Grace did concerts with Schumann and Brahms and Dvorak, and that was it. And so I did this concert with her, and it was a big success for me also. And so she did the whole tour with me and took me off to Vienna for a concert, Salzburg Festival. And so I was managed, I was heard in Vienna. That was my first concert in Vienna. And after that, other singers were interested. Grace knew Martina. Martina Arroyo wanted to perform with me, and we performed also together. It was great working with these wonderful singers, and we were doing wonderful repertoire. And then little by little, I worked also. Then Hermann Prey heard me. I should say that because of my concert success with Grace in Vienna, I was offered orchestra engagements. That's a strange thing, you know, as a so-called accompanist, to be heard by someone. The reviews were very good. As a result, the next year I was playing with the Vienna Symphony, which I did for the next 15 years, every year. Beethoven fourth with Savalisch and Ravel left hand concerto with Temirkanov. And all the while I was doing my song recitals and playing some fortepiano and some harpsichord. On the basis of one of these piano recitals, Hermann Prey happened to read the review, and then he called me up. And so the next thing I knew, he said, would you like to perform with me? So I began performing with Hermann, and that relationship lasted for 25 years. And after I began working with him, I didn't work with many other singers. I once in a while with the soprano Edda Moza, who you mentioned before, I think, Edith Matis, but that was just sort of, could you do this recital? I said, sure. But I mean, I was basically exclusively married musically to Hermann for the next, until the early 90s, and that extended even all over Europe, Japan, Carnegie Hall. Mike, there'll be three times in Carnegie Hall, the Winterreise, with German television. Can you believe Carnegie Hall with German television and a Winterreise? Anyway, that was wonderful. And then we did, of course, the 92nd Street Y, the Schubert Theater there. And that was great because, I mean, we did all the song cycles of Schubert. Prey had the most incredible repertoire. He did, I think, every lead ever written for a male voice. During the course of 10 years in Vienna, we performed every song Schubert written for the male voice. He had to learn a lot, starting with Deutsch number one and working up through the Schwanengesang. So that was really incredible. And this music, I mean, the more Schubert songs you got to know, of course, and more you can connect the songs to the sonatas, to the chamber music. It's really incredible.
Can we listen to something with you and Prey?
Absolutely. I think you've got the Dichterliebe of Schumann, if I'm not mistaken. And we recorded this twice, but I think you have a recording of us that was made early on when Prey recorded something called the Anthology of German Lieder, which entails about 40 CDs today, and I'm involved in a lot of these things. But this Schumann Dichterliebe, I think from 1972 or 73.
That was a selection from the Dichterliebe of Schumann, played by Leonard Hokanson, our guest, and the baritone Hermann Prey. Leonard, now we've talked a lot about Germany. How did you get to Bloomington?
Oh, that's very interesting because living in Germany all those years, I met my wife in Munich, and she's an American, and we got married in we began being together in 75. And at that point, when I got married, I decided, well, I'm playing a lot of concerts, but maybe some security wouldn't be a bad idea too. And I was offered a job teaching at the Hochschule für Musik in Frankfurt, which began in 1976. I had a wonderful class there, and I met James Tocco at one point, who was here in the faculty, and he asked me back, I think in maybe the beginning of the 80s or end of the 70s, if I'd ever be interested in coming to teach where he taught, which was a place called Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. I said, of course. You know, people ask you these things, and you always say yes. You want to play with the New York Philharmonic? Takes me, sure. I mean, if they call, fine, you know? So I said, that's that. And then in April of 84, a telephone call came. I wasn't home. It was on the answering machine. Oh, no, yeah. And it was from Charles Webb asking me if I would be interested in coming to Bloomington in the fall of that year. It seems that Tocco had been in the office. Eugene Istelman, I guess, was supposed to come and teach, and he decided not to. So they were in a quandary who they were going to have for a visiting professor for a year. And Tocco and Menachem Pressler talked about this, and Charles made the decision. What's so curious about that is that just a couple of days before, there'd been a telephone call from Bloomington, Indiana, from an old Army buddy of mine, whose name is Larry McConaughey, who now owns the Irish Lion. And he, out of the clear blue sky, he had called 3 days before Charles, asked, where are you and what are you doing? He got my telephone call, my telephone number from my mother. And we never answered him, but we decided this is going to be a big surprise. So we told Charles, of course, we'd love to come for a year. My dean in Frankfurt thought it was a very good idea. Also, for my prestige as far as teaching in Frankfurt is concerned, because Indiana University, I mean, not all, but so many concertmasters of German orchestras had the good fortune to spend a year or two working with Joe Gingold. I mean, you talk to people in Germany about Bloomington, and they get tears in their eyes, especially the ones who had the great opportunity to come here and work, because they don't know campus life the way it is here at IU. You know, I mean, campus, a Hochschule is not a campus in Germany. And Bloomington had an incredible reputation, which it still does. So, any case, we decided to come for a year. And we came here, and of course we surprised Larry McConaughey, who didn't have the Irish Lion yet, but he had something called the Magic Horn. And we walked in there, and he was so shocked to see us. It was a nice homecoming for us, for him. In any case, we stayed here for the year, and we really enjoyed it. We had never thought of staying. We thought, this is a good year. It's a nice time to see our parents. My parents were still living in Maine, and my Rona's parents, my wife, they were still living in Pittsburgh. So it's a good chance to, you know, renew old acquaintances. And then after our year was up, both of us, without telling the other, thought it'd be great to stay here. But we never mentioned the fact until the very end when I said, Rona, what do you think? And we both loved it. And the forces that were here at IU also wanted us to stay. So we couldn't immediately because I still had a class in Frankfurt to take care of. So I went back to Frankfurt for a year to finish up my class. And then we came back in 86. And that's how I got to Bloomington.
Well, you have a studio here too, right, where you teach?
Oh, yeah, sure. You know, just the way this is an opera school, it's also a soloist school. And there are so many pianists who have the great ability to become collaborative pianists. And they come with their Tchaikovsky concertos and Schumann carnivals, and they play very well, like about 1 million other pianists, you know. And many times I look to see if there isn't, maybe there's some feeling there for literature other than the solo literature. And I've had great good luck. And I think you know Gabriel Dobner, who performed here with Alan Bennett when you had your celebration of WFIU. He was a student of mine who now is a very successful collaborative pianist in Europe. I won't say I introduced him to Lieder. He knew Lieder, but I found that when he performed Lieder, Schumann, Schubert, he was an entirely different person. He was free, and there was something very individual about his performing, which was not there when he was trying to copy role models in the solo literature, you know? I'll never forget when he first came in and said, I have this tenor. He's a choral conducting candidate. His name is Alan Bennett. And the two of them came in to perform some Schubert Lieder for me, and I was absolutely bowled over. First of all, Gabriel's ability to perform this literature and Alan Bennett's voice, command of German diction, although he didn't speak the language. I mean, it was absolutely incredible. So we worked a lot together. And as you very well know, Alan's gone on to become a very respected member of the faculty, and we perform quite a bit now. I'm taking Gabe's place. This is one of those cases where I took over from my student, you know. And wonderful, wonderful singer and wonderful musician. And I have a couple of pianists right now. We're going to work. They're finishing their master's and going off to Guildhall School to study with Graham Johnson to continue on in this repertoire, you know. And you probably know also I'm giving an art song class. I do this on my own because this has not been done before. And there's so many singers here who aren't made for the opera. You know, there are singers outside of the opera singers, and this has been great for them. We deal each semester with either one composer, like Schubert, or like with one poet and all the settings of Goethe. That's what we did last semester. This year we're doing settings of Heine, and it's amazing the interest that's shown. I mean, that class, we meet once a week from 8:30 until about 11 at night, and we have a full house of people who want to perform and who are interested in listening. What's great is that we find listening violists, violinists, and oboists, and people who are interested in this idea of collaborative music. You know,
you mentioned collaborative a number of times. Yeah. Just who do you see in the future as the great collaborative, the great soloist, the people who are going to be shaping this literature in the future?
The young singers today aren't the way they were 50 years ago. Don Upshaw, Barbara Bonney, Bo Skofus, Thomas Hampson, they all want to work with pianists, with musicians, not with vocal coaches. They want to have people who give them impulses. They want to hear, they want to make Lieder an even sort of thing, that you've got a pianist and a singer working together, giving each other impulses. And that's so important. I think not only is it important that there are people teaching collaborative work today, but that the singers have this new attitude toward songs, and that it's a partnership and not anymore, well, I'm the great diva, I'm ready to sing, start. You know, it's not that at all. I mean, you see the pianists that are playing with, for example, with Barbara Bonney. She uses Andre Previn. She works with Vladimir Ashkenazy. And Matthias Gerner works with Alfred Brendel. I mean, it's incredible, you know. So I'll start with Fischer Dieskau, because Dieskau loved to work with different pianists. Fischer Dieskau would do the Winterreise in Salzburg each year. One year he'd do it with Murray Pariah, and they'd do with Svatoslav Richter, they'd do it with Alfred Brendel. And in Carnegie Hall, he even did it with Vladimir Horowitz, and there's a recording of that. You know, the recordings of this, Concert of the Century, when they're trying to save Carnegie Hall. And Dieskau and Horowitz. I remember having dinner with Dieskau later, much later, and asking how it was to perform the Dichterliebe with Horowitz. And Dieskau had a great sense of humor, said, "Wasn't I a good accompanist?" I love that remark, you know. That recording is yet to be heard by all, though. It's really interesting. Also, there's a movement of Tchaikovsky trio with Horowitz, Isaac Stern, and Rostropovich. Every man for himself. You know, that's really quite something. Anyway, and of course in Germany, if you're studying at the Munich Hochschule, for example, you can get a degree as a pianist in the study of Hugo Wolf Lieder. Can you believe that? And you can study in Zurich with a wonderful teacher, Erwin Gage, who is one of the most famous. He and Dalton Baldwin, Helmut Deutsch, Graham Johnson, they're the people that are taking the place of Gerald Moore, Jeffrey Parsons, sort of thing, you know?
You're retiring from IU this
yes.
year. If you were to sum up your career, and not, you know, not sounding pompous, let's say you're not yourself, and someone would say, "Leonard Hokanson, what can you tell me about him?" What would you like people to think of when they think of you?
That I was an all-round musician, I guess, more than anything else. What I would hate for someone to say, "Well, you know, he's a good song accompanist, but he didn't really play solo very well." Or "Well, he was a very good pianist, and I liked his Schubert sonatas, but, you know, he should have stayed away from Lieder." That sort of thing. I would like to have said about me that what I did as well as one thing was as good as another thing. You know what I mean? But because, you know, if you're playing Schubert lead like Hugo Schönemüllerin, that rubs off when you're playing a big Schubert sonata. You know, you're not working with somebody else; you're working with yourself. For example, in a Schubert sonata, you've got to play. You've got to be a singer many times with your right hand, and you've got to be your collaborator in your left hand. And what better way to learn that than working with a singer and then trying to transfer that to your own solo things? You know. I wasn't a jack of all trades who didn't do anything, any one thing well, you know?
You did them all well.
I mean, there are certain things I didn't play. I mean, I'm not about to, I wasn't about to play Third Rachmaninoff Concerto. I mean, I'd play all five Beethovens. Okay, so that's, or I'd play some contemporary music. Not an awful lot, but that which I liked and I felt a feeling for, you know, that sort of thing.
You have been listening to Profiles, an hour during which we meet people who make a difference in our lives and in our community. Our guest today has been Leonard Hokanson, piano recitalist, soloist, collaborator, and chamber musician. Leonard, this has been a real delight. We enjoyed having you with us.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure for me, too.
This is Bob Willard, thanking you for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in April of 2001, Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash. For WFIU, thanks for listening.